going through some personal difficulties. We were making a decision about whether or not we were going to stay together, very frankly. Everybody in a relationship, I believe, has these moments and times when there's a struggle there, and you've been together for a while, and you're not certain whether this is the right path, and you're thinking about these things and so on. And it was a very difficult time emotionally for both of us. And I can remember years and years ago, as we were going through this, what it did for me to be in that state. I became much more loving. I became much more concerned with other people. I became less concerned with the pettiness of so many things that you find yourself worked up about, because I had a different focus in my life. And I can remember thinking, as we resolved it and got back closer together, and today are very close and very loving together, looking back on that time as like something that I had to go through at that time. And that what it did is it helped me to see how absurd it is for us to be focused on the minutia of life. Whether or not the walls are clean, or whether or not the toys are put away, or whether or not your food is prepared on time, or whether somebody is late with something, or whether the phone doesn't ring or does ring or whatever. Like, all of those things are so minute in contrast to what you're really struggling with. And then what it also helped me to do in terms of getting this big picture was to look at some of the things that other people were going through, some of the problems and difficulties that they were having. Very often when something goes wrong in somebody else's life that we're close to, one of our parents gets ill, there's an accident of some kind. When Marilyn had that accident, I can remember how it affected me. And it gives you pause to remind yourself that you have a lot to be thankful for, and that you have a very powerful mind here that can make anything happen that you want to happen, as long as you keep yourself centered or keep yourself focused. I was able to shift from all those petty little things. I can remember I was doing a show out in Seattle at that time that I was going through that tough period, and somebody asked me a question that 6 months before I would have answered sort of flippantly, sort of smart alecky. It just wouldn't have given it the attention that it deserved. I would have thought of it as perhaps too trivial. And I can remember looking into the woman's eyes who asked me the show. I was on a TV show out there in Seattle, and thinking, because I was struggling at that time, I became much more compassionate towards this person, much more tuned into the pain that they were feeling, even though it seemed trivial in comparison to what I was. And it allowed me to get to be more loving. And then I look back on that now and I think, well, that's what I had to learn. That's what it was for, that there's a purpose in everything, and that perhaps one of the things that I had to learn 8 or 10 years ago was how to be more compassionate. And perhaps the only way I was going to learn how to be more compassionate was to have to go through some of this stuff myself. So, like, you can do that. You can do that now in your own life. Know that there's a lesson in this for you. Know that there are no accidents in this perfect universe. And know that the deep troubles that you may be experiencing or may be hard for have something in them for you. And that there's a secondary purpose to them. And if it does help you to slow down, and if it does help you to get a bigger picture, and it does help you to be more compassionate and more loving towards other people, then what you do is you begin to bless those things that are in your own life as offering you an opportunity to transcend them. And once you've transcended them, then you don't have to go back to that again. And for sure, my wife and I do not have to go back to ever doubting whether we want to make it and whether we want our family to stay intact and whether we want to stay loving and so on. We don't ever have to question that again. We've been there, and we both learned how to look within. And when you do look within, to be grateful for what this person is offering you. So that every time I think about my wife behaving in a way that I don't like or vice versa, we've learned how to zip it, you know, how to just not make ourselves miserable by saying things and by doing things that will just create more difficulties. Because we've been on the edge, we've been to that edge, and we've looked over the edge and seen what it's like to maybe have to raise a family as a single parents or whatever, and to be without each other. And now we're a tremendous source of strength to each other, instead of looking for the things that we don't like. So the way to the big picture often is through seeing the problems in your own life from a different perspective and seeing how difficult other people have it, you know. When you're wondering about how troubled you are, look at the Alzheimer's patient whose mind is slowly slipping away from them, and they even are aware that it's happening and they don't know what to do about it. Coming up here on the airplane yesterday, there was a story in the paper of a man and his wife who just got so desperate that they had to call the police. They have four children. Four little children under the age of 6, just like I do. And they had to call the police because they didn't want to raise them homeless. They didn't want their children, they were being evicted from the final hotel because they had raised their rent from $160 a week to $210, and they just simply didn't have it. And rather than put their children out on the street, they called the police and asked the Department of Human Resources to come and keep their children for them. What kind of problems of mind could even be anything near what it must be like to be faced with the idea of having to go out on the street with my children, my little babies? And these were little babies. One was three, one was four, and one was five. Just tiny little children to be out on the street, on the cold streets. And I made a commitment that I was going to contact them when I get back and try to get them something. And other people are helping them as well. But it also gives you time to get the bigger picture, you know, when you see things like that. It's a good thing to remember. Another thing is that in order to get this bigger picture and get to this place, that you can stop feeling sorry for yourself. You can stop the self-pity because it's happening for, you've got to trust, you've got to surrender, you've got to know that what's coming your way has a purpose in it, has a lesson in it, that there's order in chaos. And underneath that chaos, you've got to look for that order and look for that blessing. And so one of the things you might have to learn is how to get off of pity and feeling sorry for yourself. And one of the ways to do that is to start focusing on doing something new, doing something different, keeping yourself active. Marilyn would go to her knitting. I found myself getting more wrapped up in giving talks because my talks improved, literally improved when I was going through that struggle. And so did my writing because I was just experiencing more compassion for myself. The way to experience that compassion is to get yourself focused, get yourself on something, doing something, and then generally it will work out. The other thing, when you are concentrating on something else, or when you are doing something else, your mind can't be on what is wrong. And when you get your mind off of what is wrong, you get it on what is right is what expands, and what is wrong tends to go away.
One of the most alarming insights I had was 5 years ago when my grandmother died. I was with her. She was 95 years old. And she was an hour from death. And she was admitted to the hospital about 2 o'clock in the morning. And one of the things that the hospital did was that they weighed her for some reason. They had to have, you know, they're into their records and keeping track of things. You don't get into heaven if you don't have a weight certificate, and maybe if you excess baggage, you don't get in or something. I don't know what their thinking is, but there's this kind of linear, all this record keeping. I always wonder about all the people who died before we had records, before we did that. You know, whatever happened to all of them? And so she weighed 133 pounds when she entered the hospital, and we all knew that she was very close. And then life passed from her body. I mean, we watched as life literally left her body. And there she was. There was this package of, it was getting cold and stiff, and it was like this package of bones and stuff, matter. And it certainly wasn't my grandmother, that package there that was now deteriorating and going to be gone. And when they weighed her for the death certificate, she weighed 133 pounds, exactly the same. So that whatever it is that constituted her life, her very life, her very essence, is invisible and weightless. You can't weigh it. And that's true for you. That's true for every single one of us. That what our life really is all about, it defies the world of form. It defies the world of linear. And yet we spend almost all of our energy and our time here, in this part of our consciousness, in form, believing that this is who we are. When you learn to go into your mind, when you learn that your mind is really a place that you can visit and exquisitely touch the face of God, you can remove the tension and stress and everything else that's troublesome in your life when you give yourself time to experience your true humanity. Do you know, John Quincy Adams sat in the White House. He was our 6th president, and he was the most spiritual man who ever sat there, I think. He was a man who rejected slavery while other people, including one of his best friends, Thomas Jefferson, practiced it. He was a man who was highly spiritual and very intellectual, perhaps the highest intellect of anyone who ever was there. And this is what he wrote about himself 3 days before he died in a letter to Thomas Jefferson. He used his house as a metaphor for his body. And this is really the message of what I have to say here today. He said, John Quincy Adams is well. But the house in which he lives at the present time is becoming dilapidated. It's tottering on its foundations. Time and the seasons have nearly destroyed it. Its roof is pretty well worn out. I can identify with that one, I'll tell you. Its walls are much shattered and tremble with every wind. I think John Quincy Adams will have to move out of it soon. But he himself is quite well, thank you. That concept of understanding that universal intelligence that is a part of our consciousness is not just something for mystics and people to go in loincloths and contemplate in caves. It's for us. It's for every one of us in the practice of our daily lives, in whatever business we're in.
I had a hair on the pillow the other morning. I held it up to my wife. I said, "Honey, what held it in yesterday?" Something did. It's invisible. In our culture, particularly in the West, we have a tendency to believe that this is who we are. And we decorate our form, and we perfume it, and we insure it, and we build a house around it, and we mortgage that, and we watch it, and we look in the mirror, and we say, "Oh my God, look at what's happening to it, and there's another wrinkle that wasn't there before, and how did that get there?" And it's completely out of your control. It's all handled for you. There's such a beautiful lesson to learn, such a beautiful spiritual lesson to learn. If you look at a vase and watch a sculptor make a vase, the sculptor shapes his clay and finishes it up. And what is it that makes it a vase? You think it's the material? You think it's the pottery? You think it's the clay? No. It's the empty, silent space inside that the clay surrounds, that allows it to be a vase. Otherwise, it's just some pottery. What makes this a room? What makes your house a house? Think about it. It's not the walls. It's not the material that has been put all around us that you live in. It's the space, the empty, silent space inside that makes a house a house. It's the space between the bars that holds the tiger, as they say in Zen. And it's the silence between the notes that makes the music. It's not the note. That's the note. What makes the music is the silence between the notes. And so it is with you. Robert Frost put it this way, more beautifully than I could ever say it. We all sit around in a circle and suppose, while the secret sits in the center and knows. And knows. You must come in contact with that empty, silent space that is within, not the form that encapsulates it. So difficult for us in a world of bottom line, left-brained, analytical, get-to-the-point mentality that we find ourselves in. But all you have to do is look around. Look and understand that whatever the intelligence is that is in back of or suffusing all form in the universe that allows it to be that empty, silent space that some call God, some call spirit, some call soul, some call Muhammad, some call Buddha, the label doesn't matter. And I am not up here on this stage to proselytize for any particular religious point of view at all. It is not my purpose. It has nothing to do with what I'm here. It is to get you to understand the power of that invisible, silent, empty space that we all know as thought.
The awakening process, the awakened life. What a wonderful notion that is, to be awakened. It's like when you go to sleep at night and you're dreaming. The only way you know you're dreaming is to awaken. And it's a similar thing here, this awakened life business that we're talking about. When you wake up from this dream, this 80-year dream or 100-year dream, you begin to realize that the only way you know you're dreaming is to awaken. You want to create an awakening process where you really are looking back on the dream from a perspective of what is, rather than what you think it should be, or judging it. And there was a wonderful lady, some of you will have heard of her. Her name was Peace Pilgrim, and no one ever knew her real name. And Peace Pilgrim was this woman who was in her 70s when she died, I believe, and she walked all across the country, just promoting peace. She was a little old white-haired lady, and she would go on television and radio stations and just talk about how positive it could be, and then she would walk to the next city and the next. There's in one of her little booklets something that I think is really an indication of the awakened life, a real indication that you're awakening. And this is just a real short list of what some of those things are. When you see yourself moving beyond that success, that performance, that achievement that so motivates your life, and begin to awaken to a new level, to a whole new level of experience. You'll see it this way. The first thing you'll notice is a tendency to think and act spontaneously rather than on fears based on your past experiences. In other words, you begin to trust and surrender and to have a sense of spontaneity about your life. And you're not always focused on whether it's going to work out or not going to work out, and be afraid if it doesn't, and those thoughts are no longer, you're no longer wanting those thoughts to expand in your life. And then you'll notice an unmistakable ability to enjoy each moment of your life. Every moment becomes an exquisite part of your existence, and you'll find yourself, even in times when you used to think of them as boring or routine, like, oh, maybe getting in an airport and being delayed for a couple of hours, you begin to find an unmistakable ability to enjoy that and to not judge it and to see it for what it is and to even be grateful for it, that you're not getting on a plane that wasn't supposed to leave at that time. You begin to see it that way. And you begin to enjoy the little things that we so take for granted. The moments with your children, you know, the times when there's chaos around and you think, oh my God, what, I'm never going to get through this. You suddenly can stop yourself in the middle of that and see the irony and the fun and the joy in it, and the quiet times, and even driving back and forth to work, or you find yourself having this unmistakable new ability to enjoy every moment that you find in your life and to treat it all as a gift. It's a sign of the awakened life. You also find that you're developing a loss of interest in judging other people. You're off of judgment. You're moving beyond that. You understand the truth and the notion that you don't define other people with your judgments. You define yourself as someone who needs to judge. That each one of us is defined by our own thoughts and our own actions. And even those people who are behaving in ways that are antisocial and that are criminal and so on, you find yourself less judging them and more seeing them for what they are. Not saying that they shouldn't be held accountable and responsible, of course, but that judgment, that hostility, that inner anger toward them is replaced by a sense of wondering, how could that little baby at one time who was in its mother's arms turn out this way? What created that? And I wonder if there's anything I can do to help eliminate that in other children, rather than the judgment. You find a loss of interest in interpreting the actions of other people. You don't become this great interpreter for what everybody is and what everybody is doing. The awakened life beckons you to just sort of observe it, to note it. And even in your own behavior, you become less inclined to interpret it and more inclined to say that this is just an indication of where I am or where I am not at this particular moment. And with no need to analyze it. You see, when you analyze something, analyzing is really a violent intellectual act. When you analyze something, you have to break it apart, tear it apart and break it open and find out every little piece of it. It's like intellectually violent. The opposite of analysis is what we call synthesis. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin talked about the universal synthesizer is love. You begin to see how everything fits together rather than analyzing every little bit of life and interpreting everything for people. You try to do less of that and more of seeing how we all fit together. The awakened life means a loss of confrontation. You're no longer interested in it. It just isn't important to you. It's like having to prove yourself and make a contest out of everything is just no longer there for you. The real sense of the awakened life behind that is that you don't have to make anybody else wrong, and you don't have to make yourself right. That's the real sense of awakening, when you begin to know that there's much more to life than making a contest out of it. I notice that when my little boy, who's 2 years old, goes out to play any place, the only reason that he does it is for fun. I mean, he doesn't try to win, he doesn't try to beat anybody, he doesn't try to confront anybody. He just goes out to play. And we lose that in the name of confrontation and conflict. I remember Tom Crum talking in his book, The Magic of Conflict, about an example of if you were an adult and you went to a playground and you decided to sit down with a three-year-old and to make sandcastles. And you made all these beautiful sandcastles, and suddenly the three-year-old stood up and kicked your sandcastle over. What would you do with that? I mean, you wouldn't try to make him wrong and make yourself right, and you wouldn't have a fit about it, and you wouldn't scream, and you wouldn't holler, and you wouldn't say, how dare you do this such a thing, and be all upset about it, and I've made a contest out of it. You'd say, this is what three-year-olds do. They knock over sandcastles, and it's just for play. You begin to develop that more of that sense that inside every one of us is a little two-year-old who wants to come out and play and doesn't have to win and doesn't have to beat anybody and doesn't have to be in conflict or confrontation. That little child inside of you begins to surface when you start awakening. You lose the ability to worry. I didn't say you lose worry. You lose the ability to worry. It's no longer a part of you. You begin to understand the absurdity of worry. You begin to see that it makes no sense to worry about the things that you have no control over. Because if you have no control over them, it makes no sense to worry about them. And then it makes no sense to worry about the things that you do have control over. Because if you got control over them, it makes no sense to worry about them. And there goes everything that you ever worried about. You either have control or you don't. And if you don't, you move on. And if you do, you take control. As you awaken, you lose that ability to just worry about things and instead accept them. You'll notice frequent, overwhelming episodes of appreciation, as she puts it. Frequent, overwhelming episodes of appreciation. Appreciating everything, being thankful. It's one of the great ways to become awakened in your life, is to be thankful for everything and to give thanks for it. You know, I'd like to see the churches of America have services on Sunday morning where they have, like, liver appreciation day, you know, it's like to appreciate your liver every Sunday and have an ode to the liver, you know, and a theology of the liver and how grateful we are for our liver. And if we didn't have our liver, imagine, you know, and then the next week is like, you know, the heart appreciation week. It's like appreciate every little tiny thing that is a part of what it is that makes you alive, your teeth, your tongue, the air that you breathe, the ionosphere, the atmosphere, the ground, the sun, the stars, it's like you start having these overwhelming episodes of appreciation as you awaken, and you appreciate getting on a plane and having it take off and having it land and having a seat and having someone to serve you a drink and being able to wear clothes and everything about your life. And as you become more aware of how much you have and how much you have to be grateful for, you become less focused on scarcity in what you don't have, because your mind is focused on what you do have. And when your mind is focused on what you do have expands. You begin to develop contented feelings of connectedness with others and with nature. You begin to see that every human being that you meet any place on the planet shares being human with you and what it feels like to be human. You begin to see that there's a oneness to it all, that there's a universal mind, that you're a part of it. And you know that each one of us is connected and that on a round planet we can't choose up sides. As you begin to know that, then you treat the people that you come into contact with the same sense of reverence that you have for yourself. Because you are, in fact, that person. It's why Jesus said on the cross when the spear was thrown into him, "Forgive him, Father, for he knows not what he does." The reason he knows not what he doesn't know that he's throwing a spear into himself. Because every time you hurt another human being, you hurt the generic human being. You hurt all of us. And every time you send out love, you create a sense of harmony in that being. You begin to have what she called frequent attacks of smiling. You become more joyous, more merry, more contented. As you awaken and get beyond all of this need to accumulate and perform and achieve, which is all wonderful. But when you go beyond it, you begin to develop an increased susceptibility to the love extended by others, as well as the uncontrollable urge to extend it to others. Love becomes what you are, and you can't give away what you don't have, and you can only give away what you do have. And if what you have is love, then that's what you find yourself giving away. Those are the symptoms, the signs of awakening, presented by Peace Pilgrim with my editorial comments. She was a beautiful lady, and I belong to that organization that promotes her ideas.